listeners and fellow students of Hitler's Table Talk. The date is July 17, 2014, and we're bringing you episode 19 of our ongoing weekly reading and commentary. We refers to myself, Carolyn Yeager.
And me, Ray Goodwin.
And tonight, we're going to read about Hitler's reminiscences of his boyhood naughtiness with his teachers, right?
Yeah.
And he was even something of a ringleader among his naughty classmates.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he was just a high-spirited and highly intelligent boy who was particularly put off by his religion teachers, it seems.
Right.
But he wasn't the only one, and I'm sure most listeners can relate to many things that he says from their own school days. But as I recall, there were some who were always good and didn't give their teachers a hard time.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever give your teacher a hard time?
You know, I don't think I did that until I went back and started working on my degrees about 50 years after I graduated high school, 30 years anyway. But it was at that time that I had been reading and learning and educating myself about real history and whatever. And so I did kind of put some posers in front of the teachers then.
Grade school, nobody was. But starting in junior high school, seventh grade, it started where, and mm-hmm. some of the teachers really deserved it. We had some terrible teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what Hitler makes a point of, or he has made a point of elsewhere, other places, that kids know whether teachers are any good or not, or, you know, they're mm-hmm. pretty good judges, and if the teacher is that poor, they generally will tend to give that teacher a hard time. But they won't do that to their good teachers.
That's right.
Teachers that they like. But this is really kind of funny. And so I'm just ready for us to get started with it. And if you're ready, if you want to say anything before or whatever.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, Carolyn, I'll give just a little timeline here of my own involving the German military ally, the Japanese, at this time. And we're starting with the night of 8th and 9th January, 42. Japanese forces were advancing into southeast Asia, hammering the British. They're nearing Singapore, Sumatra, Borneo, the Java Sea, New Guinea, and the Allies are in great fear for Australia. And there's a lot of panic even in Australia that the Japanese are going to attack them at any time. And, of course, they're battling the American forces in the Philippines, and that goes on until the fall of Corregidor in May. But that's what's happening with Germany's ally at this time.
Well, did Japan ever have any intention of attacking Australia?
I'm not sure about that. I don't think they did, because they were extending themselves as they were already. And I think that unless Australia attacked them, I don't think that was in their plans.
Right. It says here, too, I've got the Wikipedia timeline up, and on January 10th, which would be the coming night, mm-hmm. next day coming up, says Japan declares war on the Netherlands. Mm. So, I was not aware of any of this stuff. I never really well-versed in the war in the Pacific.
Yeah.
And I guess because the Netherlands was the colonial power in a lot of those countries there.
Yeah, and that was primarily an economic thing, because the Dutch had holdings of oil and things like that in that part of the world over there, and the Japanese wanted to kick them out, take it away from them.
Yeah, on the 11th, I'm getting pretty far ahead, but we are going to get to this,
mm-hmm.
get here and pass this tonight. Japanese troops capture Kuala Lumpur in Malaya, and then Japan invades the Netherlands East Indies.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess they had to declare war on the Netherlands, or they thought they should, before they invaded their East Indies.
All right.
But that's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't recall Hitler talking about it.
no, that's right. At least nothing so far.
Sessions, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we'll go ahead and get started for the night of 8th and 9th of January, 1942. In Austria, religious instruction was given by priests. I was the eternal asker of questions. Since I was completely master of the material, I was unassailable. I always had the best marks. On the other hand, I was less impeccable under the heading of behavior.
Now, here I think it's interesting that he says he was master of the material in the religion class.
Mm-hmm.
So he, I believe that, and I think I've read this too, he said that he was reading that Bible and trying to find out everything when he was still a young kid, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He was real interested in it, and then he wants to know what it's all about. How many kids, I read the Bible when I was young too. Mm-hmm. I liked it. But how many kids, they didn't have any interest whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't read such a thing.
And he does make mention somewhere along here about he was an avid reader of the Free Thinkers. And so, anyway, I'm sure that played a part.
Yeah.
He says, I had a particular liking for the delicate subjects in the Bible, and I took a naughty pleasure in asking embarrassing questions. Father Schwarz, our teacher, was clever at giving me evasive answers, so I kept on insisting until he lost his patience. One day, I've forgotten with reference to what, he asked me if I said my prayers in the morning, at midday, and at night. No, sir, I don't say prayers. Besides, I don't see how God could be interested in the prayers of a secondary schoolboy. Sit down, then. Okay. When Father Schwarz entered the classroom, the atmosphere was at once transformed. He brought revolution in with him. Every pupil took to some new occupation. For my part, I used to excite him by waving pencils in the colors of Greater Germany. Put away those abominable colors at once, he'd say. The whole class would answer with a long howl of disapproval. Then I would get up and explain to him that it was the symbol of our national ideal. You should have no other ideal in your heart but that of our beloved country and our beloved House of Habsburg. Whoever does not love the imperial family does not love the church, and whoever does not love the church does not love God. Sit down, Hitler. Father Schwarz had a huge blue handkerchief that he used to fish up from the lining of his cassock. You could hear it when it crackle when he spread it out. One day he dropped it in class. During break, when he was talking with some other teachers, I went up to him holding the handkerchief at arm's length and disguising my disgust. Here's your handkerchief, sir. He grabbed hold of it, glaring at me. At that moment, the other boys who had gathered round me burst out into a noisy, artificially prolonged laughter.
Oh, the things that teachers have to put up with. But, you know, he's told this particular story somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It might have been in Mein Kampf or wherever, but I was, I read it not too long ago. I don't know, maybe in the last year or two.
Mm-hmm.
He told it in a longer version. And, you know, of course, when he says this handkerchief crackled,
yes,
he means that it was dirty,
yes,
you know, full of use, it had been used a lot. And so he, you know, he did this thing where he was, you know, picked it up, and then the Father Schwarz didn't know he had lost it, and he hands it to him, with, you know, like, here's this filthy thing of yours. And poor Father Schwarz didn't know what to do. You know, and I start feeling sorry for these people. But, you know, these...
Okay, he did that to him in front of other teachers, see, and that's what the gist was.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. That's how bad Hitler was. Mm-hmm.
Okay, in the Steinstrasse, Father Schwarz had a female relative of the same name as himself who kept a little shop. We used to visit her in a group and ask for the silliest objects, women's bloomers, corsets, etc. Of course, she didn't stock that kind of article. We left the shop indignantly, complaining in loud voices.
You know, I just think that's so funny. I can mm-hmm. just picture that. You just know
oh, yeah.
how these kids do that. But these boys seem to be pretty clever
mm-hmm.
In the things that they did. But they were, it was, you know, I mean, acting indignant because she doesn't have corsets in her shop, whatever the heck her shop would have been.
Mm-hmm. Just to give her a hard time because she's the relative of Schwartz.
Right, she's his relative, right.
Yeah. Opposite the school, in the Herrengasse, there was a convent. An excellent recruit came to us from Vienna, a real scamp. He used to blow kisses to the nuns when they passed a window. One day, one of them smiled back at him. At once, an old prude got up and drew the curtain violently. We even heard a cry. A half an hour later, our rector gave us a scolding, expressing his amazement at our lack of respect. If there hadn't been a few teachers who would intercede for me on occasion, the affair would have ended badly for me. Before Easter, we had lessons to prepare us for confession. It was a tremendous rag. As we had to give examples of sins to confess, we chose them in such a way as to tease Father Schwartz. One boy confessed that he had had bad thoughts about his teacher. Another said he had deliberately vexed him, and so on. The priest told us we were guilty of a grave sin in not going more deeply into ourselves and in confining ourselves to these superficial confessions. So, we agreed we would confess to a series of appalling sins. During break, I wrote out on the blackboard a terrifying confession headed by the words, "Copy out." I was busy at work when there was a whistle. It was a signal from the boy whom we'd posted to keep cave. I knocked the blackboard over and rushed to my form. The holidays went by, and everybody, including myself, forgot the matter.
Now, you know, when he says I knocked the blackboard over, that confused me for a while, but I believe it's one of those standing blackboards that swings around, and you know, there's two sides to it. So he put what he was writing facing backward and the fresh side facing the class.
Yeah, it's kind of like a larger version of an easel.
Yeah.
Holding it there, yeah. And they knocked it over, and then they said, "We forgot about it." Mm-hmm. Then he says, "At the beginning of the next term, a boy was answering questions. He filled the empty side of the blackboard, which was facing him, and when he got to the bottom of the blackboard, he turned it around. The words I'd written came into sight. I have committed fleshly sin outside of marriage." The teacher studied the handwriting, thought he recognized it as mine, and asked me if I was the author. I explained to him that this was an example of deep introspection. Father Schwartz, having told us to be very precise on the subject, "You, Hitler, keep your examples to yourself. Otherwise, I'll make an example of somebody." Often I promised myself to moderate my ways, but I couldn't help it. I couldn't endure all these hypocrites.
Hypocrisies. I think that is a very, very good line, so I need to say something about it right now.
Yes.
He says he knew he shouldn't do what he was doing, and he didn't want to upset his mother or anything if they school, you know, contacted her. And he tried to change, but he couldn't help himself when he was faced with these kinds of people. He said he couldn't stand these hypocrites. And, you know, I feel the same way. I'm the same way today on the Internet. I tell myself I should keep quiet. I shouldn't be bringing up things about this person and that person. But I just can't help myself when I see certain things going on. Mm-hmm. And so I understand. I understand Adolf.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
What drove him.
He says, "I can still see that Schwarz with his long nose. I saw red when I looked at him, and I retorted as best I could. One day my mother came to the school, and he took the opportunity to pounce upon her and explain that I was a lost soul. 'You unhappy boy,' he apostrophized me. 'But I'm not unhappy, sir.' 'You'll realize you are in the next world. I've heard about a scientist who doubts whether there is a next world. What do you, in German, do, mean? I must inform you, sir, that you are addressing me as thou. You won't go to heaven, not even if I buy an indulgence.'"
Can you believe he's saying all that? I wonder if his mother was listening to that.
"I was very fond of visiting the cathedral. Without my realizing it, this was because I liked architecture. somebody must have informed Father Schwartz of these visits, and he supposed I went there for some secret reason. The fact was, I was full of respect for the majesty of the place. One day on leaving, I found myself face to face with the priest. And there I was thinking, you were a lost soul, my son. Now I see you're nothing of the sort. This happened at a moment when Schwartz's opinion was not a matter of indifference to me, for it was the day before the examinations, so I carefully refrained from enlightening him, but he never knew what to think of me, and that vexed him. I had read a lot of works by free thinkers, and he knew it. When I bearded him with my ill-digested scientific knowledge, I drove him nearly out of his wits. At Linz, there was an association of persons physically separated, for at that time, not even civil divorce existed in Austria. The aforesaid organization was used to organize demonstrations against this barbarism. Public demonstrations were forbidden, but private meetings were allowed on condition that only members of the association were present. I went to one of these meetings, I signed a form of membership at the door, and was seized by virtuous indignation when I heard the speaker's account of the situation. He described men who were models of ignominy, and whose wives, by law, could never separate from them. I at once convinced myself that it was my duty to spread the truth amongst the public, and I wrote a play on the subject. Since my writing was illegible, I dictated the play to my sister, pacing up and down in my room. The play was divided into a number of scenes. I displayed a lofty, burning imagination. At that time, I was 15 years old.
Well, I know this story goes on, Ray, but I want to break in here because I just think, again, this tells us so much, and it's so amazing that, yes, he was 15 years old, mm-hmm. and he heard about this association of persons physically separated mm-hmm. who couldn't get a divorce, and he went to the meeting. You had to join yeah. in order to be allowed to get in, because only people who were members were allowed to participate. So he joined, you know, and they let him join, and he, you know, took it all seriously. He's always seized with virtuous indignation when he heard mm-hmm. what was going on, and he convinced himself that it was his duty to spread the truth. And I think this is just the key to him. I mean, he does feel indignation about all of these
right.
things that he sees are wrong, and he takes it upon himself. He says, well, I've got to do something about this.
That's
and he's
right.
always been that way, even as a kid.
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent point. You know, he had a burning indignation about the unfairness of that situation. And it was just one more issue that he decided to take upon himself and to let the public know, hey, something needs to be done about this. And he's 15 years old, you
yeah.
know. So.
Yeah, and he was active in Linz as a young person. Mm-hmm. And as he got, you know, just a little bit older, because he left Linz when he was still a teenager,
mm-hmm.
probably not even 18. So, of course, he didn't come back. But he went to Vienna and so on. It's hard to believe how young he was, but he was active in all kinds of things. He even, you know, entered into that architectural competition.
Correct.
One of their buildings. I don't know how old he was then. You know, he didn't win, but he thought he had the best design anyway. Okay, so.
Me, you know, Adolf, your play can't be acted. I couldn't persuade her that she was mistaken. She even persisted in her obstinacy to such a point that one day she went on strike, and that was the end of my masterpiece.
Now, but you know, I didn't hear the beginning of that. I don't know if the listeners did, but he's talking about his sister.
Yeah,
his
yeah.
sister, who he got
to write down
his play
yeah,
that he's
uh-huh.
dictating.
Yeah, and she's...
And I think she's smart enough, too. She says, you know, Adolf, this play can't be acted. He tried
uh-huh.
to persuade her differently, but he couldn't. She knew.
That's right. And then it tickles me where he says, that was the end of my masterpiece. But the thoughts I'd had on the subject were useful as providing fuel for my conversations with Schwartz. At the first opportunity, still burning with indignation, I tackled him on the matter. I really don't know, Hitler, how you managed to discover such subjects, because it interests me. It oughtn't to interest you. Your blessed father is dead, but my father has nothing to do with it. It's I who am a member of the Association of Persons Physically Separated. You're what? Sit down. I'd had Schwartz for 3 years before him. His name comes back to me now. It was Father Silisko, a great enemy of ours. One of our teachers, a certain Koenig, had been a superintendent in charge of steam boilers. One day an explosion gave him a physical shock that expressed itself in a defective pronunciation. He could no longer pronounce the letter H. When he read out the names of the class at his first lesson, I pretended not to hear, although I was sitting right in front of him. He repeated it several times, but without result. When he had identified me, he asked me why I didn't answer. My name's not Hitler, sir. My name's Hitler.
You know, I think that sounds kind of mean. But then I don't know. I was going to ask you, do you think that sounds mean, Ray? You're laughing.
I thought it was hilarious, but, you know, it's the actions of a typical 15-year-old boy with that kind of mindset.
Yeah, but, you know, the guy couldn't help it. But
right.
But then again, he said he was another one of these religion teachers, and he
yes.
had it in for the religion teachers. So
and
maybe there are other things about him that he and the other boys didn't like. So
well, that's it, Carolyn. Falls it back on exactly what you said just a few minutes ago about they could tell which teachers were, you know, for lack of a better word, incompetent or weak. And those are the ones that they would choose to do this with, and the
yeah.
good teachers, they didn't pull this sort of thing.
No.
I've always wondered why our teachers were so careless of their persons. At Steyr, we had a Jew as a teacher. One day, we shut him up in his laboratory. In his class, things were like in a Jewish school. Everything was anarchy. The teacher had no authority at all. The boys were afraid of him at first, so it seems, because he used to howl like a madman. Unfortunately for him, one day he was caught laughing immediately after being angry. The boys realized that his bouts of anger were mere play-acting, and that was the end of his authority. I had discovered in my landlady's house a huge scarf, which I borrowed from her. I tied it round my neck and went to school in this rig. The teacher asked what was the matter with me, and I answered in an indistinct murmur, making him think that I couldn't speak. He was scared of a possible infection, supposing I was in very bad shape, and at once exclaimed, "Be off, be off. Go home. Take care of yourself."
I think that's hilarious.
Yes,
who
yes.
would dream up such a thing? I mean, I would never think to do anything like that. He's way ahead of me or most anybody.
It got him out of school for a day. Hey,
it's just plain tricks like that, putting
yeah.
a big scarf around him.
I always had the habit of reading during lessons, reading books, of course, that had nothing to do with the aforesaid lessons. One day I was reading a book on diseases caused by microbes when the teacher pounced on me, tore the book from my hands, and threw it into a corner. "You should take an example from me and read serious works, if read you must." Steyr was an unpleasant town, the opposite of Linz. Linz, full of national spirit. Steyr, black and red, the clergy and Marxism. I lodged with a school companion in Grunmarkt, number 9, in a little room overlooking the courtyard. The boy's first name was Gustav. I've forgotten his surname. The room was rather agreeable, but the view over the courtyard was sinister. I often used to practice shooting rats from the window. Our landlady was very fond of us. She regularly took sides with us against her husband, who was a cipher in his own house, so to speak. She used to attack him like a viper.
Well, you know, He's going to school away from home, and he still has to be. He's just in regular school. Mm-hmm. He hasn't even graduated because he didn't graduate from mm-hmm. regular gymnasium. He was a year short. So, but he was already going to school away from where they lived, and then they stayed. You know, there were landladies or people rooms where they stayed. So he very much on their own in that sense too.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Steyr, he said, Linz was full of national spirit, and the other town that he was in, black and red, the clergy, they had parties, and they had a lot of parties, and the clergy, the Roman Catholic Party was black, was considered black, that was their color or something. Well, it's because they were, the clergy black. Were black, and the Marxist Party was red, so that, and the blacks and reds were really big in Austria and dominating, and everybody knew him and called him by those names.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's talking about his landlady and her husband here where he starts.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the sort of quarrel they often used to have. A few days before, I had asked my landlady very politely to give me my breakfast coffee a little less hot, excuse me, so that I should have time to swallow it before we set off. On the morning of this quarrel, I pointed out to her that it was already half past the hour, and I was still waiting for my coffee. She argued about whether it was so late. Then the husband intervened. Petronella, he said, is 25 too. At this remark, made by someone who had no right to speak, she blew up. Evening came, and Petronella had not yet calmed down. On the contrary, the quarrel had reached its climax. The husband decided to leave the house and, as usual, asked one of us to come with him, for he was afraid of the rats and had to be shown a light. When he'd gone, Petronella bolted the door. Gustav and I said to one another, "Look out for squalls." The husband at once injured his nose on the shut door and politely asked his wife to open. As she didn't react except by humming, he ordered her to do as she was told, but without any better success. From threats, he passed to the most humble supplication and ended by addressing himself to me, who could only answer that his charming spouse had forbidden me to obey him. The result was that he spent the night out of doors and could not return until next morning with the milk, pitiful and cowed. How Gustav and I despised the wet rag. Petronella was 33 years old. Her husband was bearded and ageless. He was a member of the minor nobility and worked as an employee in the service of the municipality.
Well, now, you know, here's another case where this is a strange story, and you think, well, you feel sorry. See, I'm always feeling sorry for people. Mm-hmm. Not always, but you feel sorry for that husband who's this woman seems to be kind of mean and bitchy.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he seems to like Petronella fine and doesn't think much at all of the husband. So he doesn't like the weak people. He likes the strong people.
Well, and too, Carolyn, this falls back on that joining that association of disassociated people or whatever.
Oh,
where
yeah.
Where the wives are having to put up with a husband that's a real louse, and there's no chance for them to divorce. And I think what he sees here is that Petronella is arching her back against this weak husband of hers who tries to order around. And I, you know, I think he's proud of her because, you know, she's exerting herself.
Well, he does favor her, and not that husband. He doesn't have any sympathy for him.
Right.
So I guess if she can assert herself and he doesn't do it successfully like those teachers of religion that try to assert themselves, but nobody, you know, takes them seriously or worries about them. So that's he's seeing that, talking about that so early in life.
Mm-hmm. He's seeing that woman as of the two, the one with backbone, the one that cares about them, and the husband, as the head of the household, is incompetent in his what he's
yeah.
supposed to do.
Although the husband stood up for him when he told his wife it was 25 till or something like that, and
yeah.
he just didn't think he had any right to say anything about it because it's her business. But anyway, I'm sure it wasn't all so cut and dried, but he does prefer the strong one.
Right, right. At that time, Austria contained a great number of noble families in straitened circumstances. I wonder whether Petronella is still alive. We were very fond of her. She looked after us in all sorts of small ways. She never missed an opportunity of stuffing our pockets with dainties. In Austria, the good women who provided lodgings for students were usually called by the Latin word crux, C-R-U-X.
Right, crux.
Yeah, right. And let's see. I looked in the dictionary on that, and it says the decisive point at issue, of course, like the crux of the matter.
Oh, not a cross. Okay.
That's, it was in parentheses cross, which is a literal translation.
Okay.
After the examinations, we organized a great party. It's the only time in my life I've been drunk. I had obtained my certificate. The next day I was to leave Steyr and return to my mother. My comrades and I secretly gathered over a quart of local wine. I've completely forgotten what happened during that night. I simply remember that I was awoken at dawn by a milkwoman on the road from Steyr to Karsten. I was in a lamentable state when I got back to the house of my crooks. I had a bath and drank a cup of coffee. Then Petronella asked me whether I had obtained my certificate. I wanted to show it to her. I rummaged in my pockets. I turned them inside out. Not a trace of my certificate. What could I have done with it? And what was I to show my mother? I was already thinking up an explanation. I had unfolded it in the train in front of an open window, and a gust of wind carried it off. Petronella did not agree with me and suggested that it would be better to ask at the school for a duplicate of the document. And since I had drunk away all my money, she carried her kindness so far as to lend me 5 gulden. The director began by keeping me waiting for quite a long time. My certificate had been brought back to the school, but torn into 4 pieces and in a somewhat inglorious condition. It appeared that in the absent-mindedness of intoxication, I had confused the precious parchment with toilet paper. I was overwhelmed. I cannot tell you what the director said to me. I'm still humiliated even from here. I made a promise to myself I would never get drunk again, and I've kept my promise. I was 15 to 16 years old, the age when all young people write poetry. I liked visiting the waxworks, and I passed for choice through the door surmounted by the label for adults only. This is the age when one wants to know all and be ignorant of nothing. I remember visiting a cinema near the southern station at Linz. What a horror of a film. Speaking of the cinema, I was present once at a showing given in aid of some charity. What was curious was the choice of films, which was more than doubtful from the point of view of morals. The Austrian state was tolerant in that sphere. I found myself cheek by jowl with a teacher named Sixtel. He said to me, laughing, "So you too are a keen supporter of the Red Cross." This remark seemed to me shocking.
Well, I don't even know what it means, but...
I gave a lot of thought to that. He initially says this they were showing this film in aid of some charity, and obviously meaning the Red Cross, but the film itself was apparently immoral. Hitler's there and kind of confronts the teacher about the immorality of that film, but the guy just ignored him and said, "Oh, I see you're a keen supporter of the Red Cross."
Yeah, it's the Red Cross charity. Okay.
Yeah.
You figure that stuff out very well, Ray.
Well, thanks. Once in a while, I can read into this. But now it says GD, and I think that means that's General Dietl, asked whether any of Hitler's teachers had witnessed his rise to power. Yes, some of them. I was not a model pupil, but none of them has forgotten me. What a proof of my character. That ends that little section.
Yeah, and there again, just one last thing here. He says he's going to a cinema showing to aid a charity. So he's still 15, 16 years old. So
16,
he's doing this stuff that adults do generally.
That's right.
Who knows? I guess he's always curious and he's always out and about and ready to go and do something.
Mm-hmm.
He had a lot of energy.
You know, what I liked about that section the most...
Uh-huh.
I you see movies occasionally about some very gifted child who is probably that age, 15 or 16, and he's so smart, his IQ is so high, that school is such a boredom and waste of his time, so he resorts to being funny or making a game of it because he's bored with the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very gifted and goes on. Now, this is a side of Hitler that nobody ever hears about, his joking, his doing things for fun, and seeing, really, I think he sees the world through almost adult eyes at that time, although he's a fully mischievous little guy that likes to have fun. And it shows a side of Hitler that is never, ever mentioned.
Well, it does. And, you know, I've read on occasion here and there how much he enjoyed jokes and mm-hmm. how much he enjoyed Joseph Goebbels because he was so funny and he'd always come up with these funny quips and Hitler would go, you know, into hilarious laughter. So, mm-hmm. you know, he did laugh a lot and if there was something to laugh at. And
yeah.
he did have that side to him for sure.
Yeah,
but at
you
the
know,
same time, he was so serious because he cared so much.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And if you'll remember a few lessons back, we were reading about, well, when he mentioned his time in the trenches or on the front in World War One, mm-hmm. and he says about his group there, he said, if we hadn't had the ability to laugh about things and to make fun of each other, he said, mm-hmm. we would have really been lost.
Yeah, he was probably really a good comrade
mm-hmm.
in the war.
Mm-hmm.
I bet he was. We don't have too many people who have any memories of him or speak about him that I've ever read.
Right. Okay, we shall move on to the night of the 9th and 10th of January, 1942. He says, I haven't been sick since I was 16. Last time I was in bed was in 1918 in a military hospital. The fact that I've never been sick makes me think that when an illness attacks me, it will have a more violent effect on me. I have the impression that it won't drag on and on. Only 10 years ago, I could fly in an aircraft at a height of 6,000 meters without the help of oxygen. The two Dietrichs fainted. It would have been different if I'd had to move, no doubt. Anyway, it was lucky that it was so, for there were never enough masks for everybody. Another time we were flying at only 4,000 meters, but Bauer had to come down with all speed to escape a storm that was beneath us. It gave me terrible headaches, which lasted all day long. That's why I greatly admired Stuka pilots.
Yeah, they, you know, now Bauer is his personal pilot and had been for a long time. but Stuka pilots, I know from reading about it that they had to, of course, all pilots are tested to see what they can endure. That makes
Correct.
A difference into what kind of planes they are able to fly. And Stuka pilots, a lot of people can't endure that sudden down rush and back up again. I don't know what makes a difference in people, but I imagine, I don't know, I don't can't imagine I would be able to.
No, me either. And, you know, he says about he could fly in an aircraft at a height of 6,000 meters without the help of oxygen. His two partners, the two Dietrichs, fainted. And he says, it would have been different if I'd had to move, meaning just sitting there, totally immobile, he could breathe without the
mm-hmm.
aid of oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
But if had he moved around, he said, I know it would have been different.
Yeah.
But so he had that ability.
Yeah. He's talking here about how strong he used to be,
mm-hmm.
but he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
He knew already. He had lost a lot of that. And when
oh, yeah.
he's talking about, when he's saying up here a little bit earlier that he thinks that because he had not been sick all his life, that when he does get an illness, it's going to have a more violent effect on him. I think that's revealing his kind of fear that something would come on him. You know,
yes.
and kind of suddenly bring him down. And
mm-hmm.
like he was, they say he was always a little worried about cancer because his mother, he watched his mother die of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But he seemed to have a kind of a feeling that that he might get some disease might take him over, which he never did. What he did get was something like Parkinson's disease.
Yes.
Which is a slow thing. It doesn't, do you in. It's just kind of a slowly debilitating thing. So he wasn't right about that exactly.
Right. And when he's saying this, he's 52 years old.
Yeah.
This was right before his 53rd birthday coming up in April. So, he's already over 50 now, and he's thinking back on these times when he was a very young fellow.
Yeah.
Recently, Goring expressed his dissatisfaction to me that Bauer had been flying a Heinkel. He insists that Bauer should always use the same type of aircraft. If he always flew a Heinkel, that would be different. As regards Bauer himself, he's delighted to have the new Condor. There's always an element of danger in flying. One is dependent, in short, on a single man. It's enough for this man to have a moment of weakness and everything's finished. Moreover, there are the atmospheric conditions. If one's caught by ice on the wings, there's nothing to do but try a chance landing, which isn't always easy. Formerly, I used to fly all the time. Today, I take care that nothing should happen to me. When the situation is easier, I'll pay less attention to the matter. I've made two landings in a fog. One comes down and doesn't know what one might run into. Once it was at Munich. We saw very dimly the red flares of the ground lighting. Bauer, who has an extraordinary speed of decision, at once dived without bothering about the direction of the wind. We were in an old Rohrbach. I had the feeling that we were descending at mad speed. Suddenly the ground rose to meet us. Bauer leveled out the aircraft at the very last moment. Already our wheels were down, but there was still the risk of running into an obstacle. Bauer succeeded in turning within a few yards of the hangars. Another time we tried to put ourselves in the same situation at Bremen. At that period the Lufthansa was infested by Jews. They let me fly when it was forbidden to fly all over the Reich territory. They obviously had only one wish, that I should end my career in an aircraft accident. Now, right there, what he's saying when he says they let me fly when it was forbidden to fly all over the Reich, meaning bad weather reports everywhere,
right.
You know.
And nobody was allowed to fly, but somehow they said, okay, your plane can go.
Yeah, and it was infested by Jews, and he said they were the ones that tell him, hey, go right ahead.
Yeah, so, well, that's what he's saying. And they had to rent these Lufthansa planes, I guess.
Yeah, he said they obviously had only one wish, that I should end my career in an aircraft accident. We were coming down blindly when the ground rose up. Bauer had just time to level out and thus avoid a herd of cattle. Yet another time we had to go through three storms in succession. It was in the direction of Brunswick. How many times we made forced landings in the fields. On the 29th of July, 1932, for example, at Ulm. On another occasion, I said to Bauer, we must go. We're expected at Munich. We had no equipment for night flying, so Bauer had an improvised lighting system installed. On arriving at Munich, we wheeled around above the stadium. It was at the time of the Papen elections when we got our 297 seats. That same day, I'd had meetings at Constance, Friedrichshafen, and Kempten. At the meeting in Munich, I could hardly speak. I was dizzy. As I went back home, I thought I was going to faint. I got nothing easily in those days. I remember I once spoke at Stralsund at 3 o'clock in the morning. These rapid, incessant moves were due to the necessity of my speaking sometimes in great halls and sometimes in the open air. And we didn't always have a choice of dates. For example, on my birthday, 1932, and that would be April the 20th, the day before, I'd held six meetings at Königsberg, the last ending at 2:30 in the morning. I was in bed by 5, and by 8:30, I was back on the airfield. A young girl of ravishing beauty offered me a nosegay, and I regarded that as a happy omen. Meetings at Schneidermühl, at Kassel, then at Göttingen, where from 40 to 50,000 people were waiting for us in the night under torrential rain. Next day, at 3 o'clock in the morning, we set out by car for Wiesbaden, Trier and Koblenz.
Wiesbaden.
Yeah, there you go, Wiesbaden. The organization of these round trips was very difficult, for we had to take mainly into account the possibility of getting hauls. Often I had to use a little junker, single motor, that had belonged to Sepp Dietrich. It was a rather unstable aircraft, and we were violently shaken by the bad weather. Bauer once set it down on a race course. He did better than that, for he succeeded in starting off again in black darkness. As a matter of fact, we had no meteorological protection. My very first flight at Munich to Berlin was so unfavorable that I spent years without entering an aircraft again. You know, just stopping right there, what he has, if you've noticed and picked up on, he is really praiseful of his pilot, Bauer, and the way he's handled that plane during the most dangerous and deadly of conditions. And I think he's taking pride in his personal pilot there.
Well, I think Bauer had to have been a very good pilot, and that's why they made him Hitler's pilot and why Hitler made him his pilot. He's also saying that my life was in his hands.
Right.
I mean, he's doing all this, and we're going straight down, and we see that all of a sudden the ground shows, you know, comes up at you. It must be a scary, scary feeling.
Oh, absolutely.
But if the pilot knows what he's doing, then he straightens out, and you have to do it that way, I guess you do. It's when you're flying like that, well, that's pretty dangerous. And he's making it clear, I don't know if that's what he wants to do, but he's making it clear that he put himself in a lot of danger during all that campaigning. And then, you know, the hours they kept and the many places they went to. So that just lends itself even more to accidents possibly happening. But that was how they had to do it, because they were committed to winning.
You know, I'm going to interject something here. Years ago, I was reading an article about the first airplanes and then the advancement on up into the after 1915 to 1930, and that some German came up with the idea, when pilots are there and they're facing the dashboard and they've got all of these instruments to read, whether that's wind speed or oil pressure, fuel, and all this stuff, and they had these gauges, they would have to look away from where they were flying to each gauge. And they had to check each gauge, and that took a little bit of time. And some German fella came up with the idea of synchronizing all of those instruments on the panel there, those faces that he would have to read, to where all the arrows were facing the same way if things were normal. And that a quick glance from one side to the other, they could see if any of the arrows were out of line immediately. But if they're all facing the same direction, then it only takes a second to scan that instrument panel. And it's just a little thing, but it's a technological advance.
Oh, yeah, because you have to be able to just look and see. You can't study each thing individually, but I guess you're saying that's what they did have to do before you did that.
Yeah.
Well, there you go, another German innovation.
There you go. Now, he says, my weakness is for motor cars. I owe it to some of the finest hours of my life. The Rhine, seen from the air, is no great shakes. In a car, it's better, but the ideal thing is in a boat. As regards the East, the only means of locomotion is the aircraft. Here, there's nothing to lose. When we have built our first Autobahn, Bonnen, dotted every 100 kilometers by a little town that will remind us of Germany, that will already be better.
That's funny. And he says he's thinking about the Autobahn. They have to dot it every so often with a little town that reminds them of Germany, so they'll feel like they're at home.
Yep. These Autobahnen will have to be different from ours, or else the travelers will be seized by the boredom of the journey and will have crises of agoraphobia, which is a fear of wide open spaces. The way from Cologne to Bonn is already difficult to endure. When I go from Berlin to Munich, my fancy is continually being taken by lovely things. but 1,000 kilometers over a plain, that's terrifying. We shall have to populate that desert. The Autobahnen of the East will have to be built on ridges so that they'll remain clear during the winter. The wind must be able to sweep them continually.
See, there you go. Now he's thinking about that, how the weather can get in the way of traveling on the Autobahnen. So they should be built on ridges.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very short. Next one here says, 9th of January, 1942, evening. Nowadays, humanity depends basically on the whale for its nourishment with fats. I gather that the number of whales in the seas of the world tends rather to fall than to increase. The East will supply us with the vegetable fats that will replace whale oil.
See, but there, you know, vegetable fats don't replace fish oil.
Mm-hmm.
So he had his hopes up there with his vegetarian outlook, but we've learned that vegetable oil does not commensurate with animal fats,
mm-hmm.
which is what we really need.
Mm-hmm.
But still, he was thinking about the whales.
That's right.
Yeah. It's nice to think that you could just live on vegetable stuff and grains and so on, but it doesn't work that way.
Yeah. 10th of January, 1942, evening. Japan is in the process of making itself independent in all fields. It's guaranteeing its supplies of rubber, oil, zinc, wolfram, and a number of other products. And this wolfram, W-O-L-F-R-A-M, is tungsten.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, and what kind of a metal is tungsten? It seems to be...
It's a combination... It's a combination of manganese ore with iron ore.
Well, is it kind of... Does it liquefy or something? I mean, is it real hard or is it kind of soft?
Yeah, tungsten. When it's refined, it becomes, your filaments and light bulbs, tungsten.
Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
And they carry very conducive to carrying electricity a whole lot better than other metals. And it's an important material in a lot of aircraft industry as well. So tungsten, or wolfram, as he called it here, Japan is making itself independent. Japan will be one of the richest countries in the world. What a transformation. This country, that as recently as a few weeks ago was regarded as one of the poorest. There are few examples in world history of a more rapid and complete reversal of the situation.
Of course, it wasn't permanent.
Right.
But they were going strong there. They had, well, you know, conquering, I guess you could say, or winning the battles in these various Asian places, they got access to all these natural resources that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
So it was looking good for them at that time.
Yeah, and it was strictly a nationalistic viewpoint too, Carolyn, because the Japanese looked at the United States and they said, you know, here's the USA, and they have complete control of the Western Hemisphere, meaning North and South America, economically. They've set up trading partners and markets, etc. And the British, they have theirs in Europe and their outposts. And it's only right that we, as the strongest and best power in Asia, we should be the dominant power economically in this part of the world, which is, to me, a very fair outlook.
Well, I think so, too. They weren't wrong in thinking like that. But it's always the same. It's the same hypocrisy.
That's right.
America and the British Empire, what they do, it's okay for them to do it,
mm-hmm.
but it's evil and wrong for anybody else to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's just what it all boils down to.
Yes.
Look at that, you know, for Germany, I'm working on something that does bring up the idea of a German empire that Hitler could foresee or was looking to create a German empire out of the Germanic nations. They called it an empire. Oh, how terrible that. Oh, that's so. Oh, what a horrible man. But, you know, Britain had a British empire. Nobody saw anything wrong with that.
That's right.
Of course, after the war, they decided it wasn't so okay for Britain to have this empire, and they started losing it.
Mm-hmm.
But,
Anyway, he says, the wealth of Great Britain is the result less of a perfect commercial organization than of the capitalist exploitation of the 350 million Indian slaves. The British are commended for their worldly wisdom in respecting the customs of the countries subject to them. In reality, this attitude has no other explanation than the determination not to raise the native standard of living. If we took India, the Indians would certainly not be enthusiastic, and they'd not be slow to regret the good old days of English rule. The climax of this cynical behavior of the English is that it gives them the prestige of liberalism and tolerance.
Well, but, how do you understand that?
Well, he's saying that the English seem magnanimous as empire, whole, you know, as an empire ruling country, because they allow the native peoples in the lands that they have taken over to go along with their own customs and their own rights and everything, and this gives them the appearance of tolerance and liberalism, when in reality, he says it's strictly an economic thing, because the last thing they wanted to do was to raise the standard of living of those occupied countries and make those people smart enough to start thinking, hey, you know what, they're taking our natural resources here. This is not a good thing for our nation. And so he said their British success is less due to that magnanimous reputation that they seem to have than just keeping the subject populations in ignorance and poverty and not educating them. That's how I took it.
Well, yeah. And, you know, and then Hitler has said that he thought the British were smart for doing that.
Yes.
If they wanted to keep their empire, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what he meant when he was saying earlier and on earlier occasions, we don't want to educate the Russians, you know, the
mm-hmm.
Russian
yeah.
peasantry, mm-hmm. and we don't want to do this or that. We'll just leave them the way they are and let them do the way they do, and we'll just supervise the place. People find fault with that, with him saying something like that. Mm-hmm. But then this is exactly what the English were doing.
Sure.
And
he saw their success with it.
Yeah, right.
So, in this next paragraph, one of the first words we're going to have is suttee, S-U-T-T-E-E. And that was the practice of self-immolation on the husband's funeral pyre under the Hindu religion.
Yeah, of the wife.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And he says, the prohibition of suttee for widows and the suppression of starvation dungeons were dictated to the English by the desire not to reduce the labor force and perhaps also by the desire to economize wood. They set so cleverly about presenting these measures to the world that they provoked a wave of admiration. That's the strength of the English, to allow the natives to live whilst they exploit them to the uttermost. There's not a single Englishman at this moment who isn't thinking constantly of India. If one were to offer the English this alternative, to keep India whilst abandoning Europe to Germany, or to lose India while retaining the control of Europe, I'm sure that 99% of them would choose to keep India. For them, India has likewise become a symbol for its own India that she built the empire. Out of 450 million subjects, the King of England has 350 million Indians.
Yeah, most of his subjects.
Mm-hmm, right. Confronted with America, the best we can do is hold out against her to the end. Now, that was a fascinating statement to end that little section with, and it just stands by itself, but it's very thought-provoking. The Americans are in the war now, and he knows that's a ton of more industrial output thrown against his forces. And he says, you know, like facing the Americans, the best we can do is hold out against her to an end. Now, of course, he's talking economic advancement, exploitation, too. But I thought that was some kind of statement.
Yeah, well, it seems to me he's saying we can't defeat
yes,
America, but we can
exactly.
hope to come to some victory.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise,
if I just hold out.
I mean, if we can get victory in the Soviet Union, we can, you know, mm-hmm. reach our goals in Russia. That is quite a statement. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. You know, this Satie thing, shouldn't get off the track, but it really interested me because I read in reading about it that the idea, not all Indians agreed with this, but mm-hmm. some of them did, a woman's role in life, here we get into this again, was
yes.
solely to take care of her husband and her sons and so on. And when her husband died, she had no purpose whatsoever. This is the thinking behind it. And so she had to die along with him because she didn't have a right to live anymore.
That's right. That's the correct interpretation.
Pretty yeah. crazy.
Mm-hmm. And then the British, of course, banned that practice.
Yes, they did.
Yeah. Okay, we'll move on to the 13th of January, 1942, midday. Special guests, Dr. Porsche and Jacob Werlin. The water-cooled engine will have to disappear completely. Instead of obtaining petrol from coal by a complicated process, it's preferable to compel certain categories of users to employ vehicles equipped with gas generators. Just
that's
brief
short.
Statement.
What's he talking about here, gas generators? The gas-generated vehicles?
Yeah.
But they had a lot of those in Germany.
Yeah. Well, and to that, I think that just was a statement that, once again, it shows as an example of the all-ranging thinking of this guy, the subject matter that he would cover and touch on.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, when they were having to make petrol from coal.
Yes.
And he's saying that, you know, that's not easy. And they need to find sources of gas, probably.
Yes, yes.
But also, the water-cooled engine, you want the air-cooled engine, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what the Volkswagen had, an air-cooled engine?
Mm-hmm.
The engine was in the back.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, and I think he talks a little bit about that later on here.
Oh.
But, you know, an interesting point about that last statement, Carolyn, is that he's talking about they have to generate, make petrol using coal, you know, mm-hmm. to heat, refine, things like this.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the history books and history classes today, the Germans were using train load after train load of coal to burn these gas Jews. You know, over 250 million tons
yeah.
of coal it would have taken to cremate all those bodies. And so, anyway.
They didn't have it to spare. It's just...
No, that's no way that could have been done. Okay, we'll move on to the night of the 12th, 13th, January 1942.
Okay.
In the Wehrmacht, there used until now to be no obligation to confirm the carrying out of an order except at lower levels. I've just changed that. Without this obligation, there's a risk that people may consider an order as having been carried out simply because it's been given. One must have a confirmation so as to be quite sure.
You know, now here he's talking clearly. He's already aware that some of these officers are not carrying out his
mm-hmm.
orders
mm-hmm.
As given, and some of the generals even. And now, you know, we already... mentioned a while back that he had become commander-in-chief, as you might mm-hmm. call it, or whatever.
That's right. That's right.
Of the German armed forces and certainly the army. And so he's the top guy now that, you know, that gives out the orders, and he's running the war. And so he's making some changes.
Well, that's a very good point, and it's right on the money, because he had several high-level military commanders that when they saw an order that came from Berlin, from Adolf Hitler, to do this or do that, and if they didn't think it was worth the effort or that they wanted to do it, they'd ignore it, and nothing ever came of it. And then when Hitler would ask, what's the progress of this operation? The embarrassment. We hadn't started it, sir. And so he started this process or procedure of when an order goes to you, I'm going to have a response on it. You've got to confirm the carrying out of this order. And right. That's exactly what you just said. That's what it involves.
And there's been all this criticism of his orders, but I was reading some very interesting material that was on a page about Alfred Jodl, where it went on and on. A lot of documents and orders and things, like some of those, like the Commissar Order, some of these kind of orders that they've made very famous controversial. Oh, it's so terrible to have an order that as soon as, if you captured a Commissar, he was to be executed. I think that makes all the sense in the world myself.
Certainly, I do too.
But we have to have a trial. We have to make sure he's guilty of something. Oh, we can't do this. This is a war crime. What about the conventions? We don't know if this fits the Geneva Conventions, and on and on. And they didn't want to do these things. And I just say, I finally came to the conclusion, you know, if all these officers and generals had followed Hitler's orders as they were supposed to do, without their moral qualms that they were, some of them were having, then I bet things would have gone better. They screwed it up because they thought they knew better how to run an army. They were from the old Reichswehr and so on, and they resented him, coming along, But if they would have carried out those orders, I bet things would have gone a whole lot better. And I know in some cases they would have.
Sure.
But they try to play it now like, oh, he was just off the wall.
Right, right. And you know, we're on the same page exactly there, Carolyn, because I can't tell you how many times I have heard over many, many years, boy, if old Hitler would have just left his generals alone, they would have whipped Russia and all this stuff. And on the contrary, I think that exactly the opposite is the truth. If those generals would have carried out his plan, you never know. It certainly would have turned out a lot more positive than it did.
I think so, too.
You know, because he was the man was a military genius just as he was a political genius.
Well, he worked all those things out. He devoted himself to strategy and coming up with these strategies, and he explained it all to his officers and so on, and he knew he had to persuade them, and he worked real hard at doing that, and they all, okay, and then they'd go off, and a lot of them wouldn't do it.
That's true.
How can you run a war that way?
Yeah, and then he goes into some examples here. He says the supplying of the front creates enormous problems. In this matter, we've given proof of the most magnificent gifts of improvisation. Amongst the unforeseen matters in which we've had to improvise was that catastrophe of the temperatures falling in 2 days from 2 degrees below zero to 38 degrees below. That paralyzed everything, for nobody expected it. The natives themselves were surprised. They confirmed that winter came on in a quite unusual fashion. Given the present wartime conditions, one may ask whether the most competent officers should be at the front or the rear. I say they should be at the front. During the First World War, we had a total of 40,000 motorized vehicles. Today, a single one of our units has as many. What was the situation 8 years ago? We had 7 divisions of infantry and 3 of cavalry. Nowadays, we have nothing but armored divisions and motorized divisions. That's why I need officers, always more officers. In the spring of 1938, we entered Austria. On the stretch from Linz to Vienna, we saw over 80 tanks immobilized by the side of the road. And yet, what an easy road it was. Our men hadn't enough experience. A year later, we went into Czechoslovakia, and nothing of the sort happened. We need a suitable organization for the interior. We're forced to entrust some officer with responsibility for a dump of materials. Now, he may be a lieutenant of the reserve, a dentist, or a teacher in civil life. Naturally, these good fellows have no idea of the maintenance of material, and they have to begin by gaining their own experience. Let's not forget that the German army has gone ahead with crazy speed. Our present difficulties are the same, in a worse form, as those we met with in 1938 during our advance on Vienna. Next winter, none of that will be reproduced. We'll not see a single truck or locomotive immobilized because of the weather, I mean.
Well, now, how can he be sure about that? And here when he talks about a dump of materials to entrust some officer with responsibility for a dump of materials, and by materials it seems he means everything from tanks to, you know.
Warm clothing, everything.
Yeah, and
like
everything.
That.
Mm-hmm. These soldiers, a lot of them don't have any experience in things like that, so mm-hmm. they don't know, and that you need somebody who does. I'm not sure what he's talking about here.
Well, I think he's leaning on the advancement in technology in the labs that the German scientists are producing, and also the fact of getting the oil they need to the front, the fuel they need to the front,
mm-hmm.
and these weather shutdowns can be dealt with. And he said it hit by such a surprise in this bodacious winter that even the natives are saying there's not been none like that winter in their memory. And so it caught them totally by surprise. And I think what he's saying is if they know that this may happen again, they will be better equipped to deal with it.
Well, it's a question of the supply.
Yes.
The supply lines and everything. Mm-hmm. And they're always having a problem with that.
Right.
But so he's saying that they need something for the interior that will be responsible for that. Well, sure. I don't know, but I know that there's always off and on problems with supply. But then all armies have that.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just the German army. They make the plans are made, but there are too many things that can go wrong that aren't taken into consideration. Probably can't be. So I don't know how he can promise and say that's not going to happen next year.
Yeah. But, you know, it's a catch-22 situation for the Germans. You got a plus and a minus here when he says, let's not forget the German army has gone ahead with crazy speed. Now, the positive part of that is they have grabbed more territory and captured more prisoners and pushed more enemy forces backwards than anyone could have ever imagined. But at the same time, it extended those lines of communication as well as supplying.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bad side of that was the troops at the front didn't have what they needed, and that means the winter clothing and oil and whatever to keep their machines running. So.
Yeah, but I still don't think that's any excuse. I mean, his plan going into Barbarossa, into the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. was to do it fast.
Yeah,
and he said speed was of the essence.
That's
and
right.
they intended to move fast and take it over.
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading things about the plan. It was like one after a certain amount of time, you're going to have to get all of your food and all of your goods and so on from the local area that you're in from Russia
mm-hmm.
from the Russians. I don't think they ever were able to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
He says, as soon as these regions are incorporated in our rail network, we'll build locomotives adapted to local conditions. In this field, I make no reproaches to anybody. Material of that sort can't be conjured up. It has to be built. But until now, we had no reason to make machines designed for any other climate than our own. Even this year, the winter wouldn't have caused us any difficulties if it hadn't surprised us by its suddenness. Yet it's lucky it came so suddenly, for otherwise we'd have advanced another 200 or 300 kilometers. In that case, the adaptation of the railway to our gauge wouldn't have been possible. In such temperatures, we're obliged to have recourse to traction by animals.
You know, when he says, I make no reproaches to anybody, well, he shouldn't, because he would have to reproach himself.
That's right.
Truthfully, since he's the top guy, and I think that because the decision to go into Russia was made and it was kind of in a hurry, although they were delayed, but it was hard to everybody's got their job, they're thinking about this part and that part. It's hard to to be completely prepared for something
sure.
like that. And they really didn't have as many men and planes and tanks and therefore as would have been ideal, far from it. but, you know, they were going to make do. So then he says, we have no reason to make machines designed for any other climate than our own. Well, now, wait a minute. If they knew they were going into this other world and a different climate, well, then they would have to make machines designed for that.
Well, I think that the thing to do with that is the rarity of, you know, they talk about a 100-year flood or a 500-year flood.
Yeah,
well,
the temperature.
What was this particular winter was the most savage in decades.
That's true. And then they may have had the plan to use all the captured Russian equipment.
Right.
So they always did, everybody did that when they had the opportunity to do it. So,
well, you know, the German railroad track gauge was a different size than the Soviets. And so the Soviets started wising up, and their commanders told their troops to destroy the rail equipment so that the Germans couldn't use it. Locomotives, rail cars carrying equipment, things like this, to destroy it if you can't get away from them. And so not only was the Germans had to move that out of the way, but then they had to take that Russian gauge railroad track and rebuild it to conform to their trains, and that slowed down the
they had all
the ability to get supplies.
To and it's true that the Russian scheme was then, you know, to destroy everything in their path as they retreated, not leave anything. I mean, not even a radish, you know, if they could help it. So,
exactly.
Yeah, and it was tough. It was the toughest thing I probably, God,
yeah. On the front at Leningrad, with a temperature of 42 degrees below zero, not a rifle, a machine gun, or a field gun was working on our side. But we've just received the oil we unfortunately lacked 2 months ago. We lacked two things, a fur helmet and a celluloid mask. Goring tells me that he knew because he'd used them when shooting the warming bags one finds on Russian soldiers. How long have I been clamoring for an air-cooled motor? But it's like talking to a wall. The thickest wall of all is human stupidity. The military were against it in the same way as they were against the Volkswagen at first. What a price the special petrol for starting up our engines is now costing us. It goes without saying that it would be different if we had under every bonnet a heater working by catalysis. I gave an order for them. It will be forbidden in the future to build engines except with air cooling. Almost everything we lack today we already had in the First World War. It's strange to see how quickly a human being forgets. Everything has to be constantly reinvented.
Yeah, well, I go along with his complaining there. I think he's right. He thinks of these things, but nobody else does, and he can't get them to care about it.
Right, and you know, with an air-cooled motor, what is normally used, of course, is a radiator and water. Well, what happens to that at 42 degrees below zero? It totally immobilizes any piece of equipment.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's what he's making reference to there. Churchill is a man with an out-of-date political idea, that of the European balance of power. It no longer belongs to the sphere of realities, and yet it's because of this superstition that Churchill stirred England up to war. When Singapore falls, Churchill will fall too. I'm convinced of it. The policy represented by Churchill is to nobody's interest, in short, but that of the Jews. But that people was chosen by Jehovah because of its stupidity. The last thing that their interest should have told the Jews to do was to enter into this war. All that they'll have gained by it is to be chased out of Europe, for the longer the war lasts, the more violently the peoples will react against them. At the bottom of all this upheaval are a few imbeciles. In fact, one must see things as they are. What is that Moroccan Jew whom Great Britain made a minister of war? The generals finally broke him, as Wavell has just done to Duff Cooper. I regard Halifax as a hypocrite of the worst type, as a liar. On the whole, it's visible that sympathy between the English and the Americans is not booming. On the side of the English, it's antipathy that's booming, in fact. But for Japan's intervention in the war, their accounts would have been balanced. But now it's definitely England who's paying for the broken crockery. Will fine speeches from Roosevelt be enough to make up for the loss of India? I don't think the Japanese will embark on the conquest of India.
Well, let's go back into that. He's talking about the Roosevelt and Churchill and so on. And he says the Moroccan Jew, that's got to be that Orbelisha. Because
correct.
He's the one who did become Minister of War.
Mm-hmm.
In the first years of the war, he didn't. Then he was replaced by somebody else in the last couple of years. But so he would have been there. He really doesn't like that guy. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But again, Hitler thinks that the Jews are going to they're going to be revealed, and then it's going to be a general desire to get rid of them. But that didn't happen.
That's right.
And it still doesn't happen, and you have to wonder, he was going by that probably in a lot of those things he said, like if the Jews force war on Europe again, it will not be the Europeans who pay for this, but it will be the Jews themselves. Well, see, he thought that people would respond in a kind of a way, but no, they don't, because the Jews have got it figured out. It has to be how to deal with the situation to twist things around.
Yes, how to dupe people.
And they know the kind of power that they have, which I think Hitler was not, and who did know the extent, I guess, of their monetary control.
Yes. You know, that saying about supposedly attributed to Meyer Amschel Rothschild, 1754, where he says, "Give me control of a nation's money and I care not who makes its laws." Meaning, of course, it doesn't matter whether the government is a capitalist or whatever, as long as they control the money. But, you know, to me, equally important is their control of everybody's means of communications, with the print media, with the electronic media, and they're conditioning people's minds. And what Hitler was saying there, he expected people to wake up to the evidence that the Jews were perpetrating this war, that they started it for their own interests. And he thought people would surely wake up and realize that this would happen. But because of that hold on the minds of people, it didn't happen.
And, you know, in Germany, the National Socialists got control of the media.
Mm-hmm.
And they had control of the country, and they were putting out the right information. But everywhere else, it was wrong. And even Germans wanted to hear what the BBC had to say, and the people were listening to around the world, and they were being, to some degree, probably influenced. But Germans were pretty much behind things, although there was a whole number of resistance people, resistors. Yeah, it's it eludes us, this power of the Jews. It seems to be something we can't really understand or do anything about. I mean, I hate to say it that way. You can't do anything about, but it's always underestimated, I guess I should say it that way.
Right.
And it's just humanitarianism. It's just, fear of collectively blaming people. And, there's all these nice ones. It can't be that, you know, and there's bad people everywhere and blah, blah, blah. That's what gets it. And this seems to be a universal way of thinking amongst human beings.
Right. Okay.
I know we're running out of time here. How long is this chapter?
Okay, we can get as I might can finish reading it. So,
I'll be quiet.
We'll get after it here. I don't think the Japanese will embark on the conquest of India. They'll surely confine themselves to blockading it. And if their communications with India are broken, what will be the gain for the English in being still masters there? Besides, their position is very peculiar. There are 350,000 of them to govern 350 million people. If suddenly the 350 millions declare they won't fight anymore, what are the English to do? I suppose that in Germany at the time of the Weimar Republic, the general strike would have been rigorously applied. What could an army of 100,000 men have done against that? There are no bloody insurrections in India today, but the difficulty for the Indians is to reconcile the divergent interests of such a diverse population. How are the princes and the Brahmins, the Hindus and the Muslims, all of these higher hierarchized and partitioned castes to be combined in a common front. If a British newspaper in India writes an article today attacking Churchill, that's because it can't do anything else, or it would lose its whole public. The press doesn't give an exact picture of the reality. In India, revolt is an endemic condition. Gandhi tried to succeed by pacific methods, but whatever be the methods chosen, the Indians are unanimous in their desire to shake off the British yoke. Some of them would like to try Bolshevism for that purpose. Others would like to try us. Others would prefer to owe nothing to the foreigner. For all, the object is the same. It's liberty, and nobody cares about the state of anarchy that will follow in India upon the departure of the English. When one treats a people as the English have continually treated the Indians, the unpardonable folly is to send the youth of the country to the universities where it learns things that would be better for it not to know. After all, Singapore is not Crete. I try to imagine what we would do if such a blow fell on us, but there's no means of comparison, for we don't possess a worldwide empire. How are they going to react to that? Of course, they have in reserve men like Mosley. When I think that Mosley and more than 9,000 of his supporters, including some belonging to the best families, are in prison because they did not want this war. Mark my words, Borman, I'm going to become very religious. Borman says, you've always been very religious. I'm going to become a religious figure. Soon I'll be the great chief of the Tartars. Already Arabs and Moroccans are mingling my name with their prayers. Amongst the Tartars I shall become Khan. The only thing of which I shall be incapable is to share the sheikh's mutton with them. I'm a vegetarian, and they must spare me from their meat. If they don't wait too long, I'll fall back on their harems. That's it. So,
well, that's funny where Borman is saying that, isn't it? Well, I guess we can end on time then.
Okay.
It would be fun to talk about that just a little bit, but I think I got to play the music now. So
I
want to thank everyone for listening and tell you we'll be back here next week. So good night, all.
Good night.